From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. After Tunisia, after Egypt, calls for change have spread across North Africa and the Middle East.
Holding anti-government signs and chanting out loud, Algeria, free and democratic.
Soldiers in the southern port of Aden. If confirmed, it will bring the total number of known deaths in the Yemeni uprising to 12. The demonstrators are calling for the overthrow of President Ali Abdullah Saleh, who's been in power for 32 years.
Bahrain is in crisis. Tonight, protesters tried to march to the city centre again. This was the response. The police and the army opened fire, using tear gas and bullets.
Algeria, Yemen, Bahrain, and remarkably, Libya, where Muammar Gaddafi has kept his grip on power for more than 40 years. On February 15th, protests erupted in the Libyan city of Benghazi, and news organizations were faced with covering a country where the information blackout was near total. With virtually no foreign reporters on the ground until week's end, the world relied on the testimony of Libyan eyewitnesses, reporting by cell phone, by Twitter, and by all available means, often at grave personal risk. The result was a tapestry of violence and resolve, a tapestry recognizable and stirring, but each stitch of which was uncorroborated and unconfirmed.
Some witnesses say Gaddafi's regime has lost the eastern city of Misrata. CNN's unable to independently confirm that.
A deadly protest. Journalists not allowed in, but these pictures provided by people risking their lives and finding ways around a government information blackout.
Unconfirmed reports say hundreds of people have already been gunned down on the streets in protest. Libya has banned foreign media, so it's very difficult to confirm anything at this point.
The details of the regime's brutal crackdown were elusive, but the stories emerging from Libya reminded us that Muammar Gaddafi is first and foremost a ruthless dictator, not the eccentric buffoon as portrayed by the Western media for the past decade.
He is a fan of horse racing and flamenco dancing. His near-constant companion, a Ukrainian nurse described as a voluptuous blonde.
Colonel Gaddafi also, of course, brought along his entourage of 40 women bodyguards. 40 of them, all women.
And Mr. Gaddafi pitched his tent on Donald Trump's property in Bedford and caused a stir. It was not a camping tent, but a ceremonial tent for receiving guests.
That gaping hole in relevant context and the current stranglehold on information placed a heavy burden on the Libyan dissident diaspora, Libyans and Libyan Americans here banding together to get information into and out of their country. One of the members of that diaspora is OTM producer Sara Abdurrahman. For weeks, Sara's deep understanding of Arab politics has been invaluable to us in framing our reporting, but this week, for this particular story, Sara stepped out of her role as dispassionate journalist as she witnessed the potential for dramatic change in her home country. She has worked feverishly to get information out of Libya and into the mainstream media here and around the world. Her role was to telephone people inside of Libya, to record the conversations, and to post all of those findings on a Twitter feed called Feb 17 Voices, named after the date of the, quote, day of rage in Libya. Once again, in the interest of transparency, we want to be very clear that when it comes to this story, Sara is not an OTM producer, but rather an OTM source. Journalists are, of course, trained never to become part of the story. So we asked Sara about her dual role as Libyan activist and journalist.
Libya is one of the most closed-off societies and one of the most difficult places to get information in and out of. And if I have people that I can get in touch with there and get information out to put a spotlight on it, then, I mean, it's a duty. There's no question. I've purely been trying to get the information out. And if the people that are around me want to make comments about it, editorialize, retweet, do what they want with it, that's fine. But I still do recognize my role as a journalist and that I can't get too involved in that regard.
We're speaking on Thursday. Last Thursday at this time, you were commencing a very interesting weekend. Tell me how you spent last weekend.
We had expectations that something big was about to happen in Libya. With the uprisings in neighboring Tunisia and Egypt, and then things starting to develop in Bahrain and in Yemen and even Algeria, we knew that something was likely to happen. And February 17th was designated the Day of Rage. And so we sort of wanted to be prepared that if something did happen, that we could make sure to get information out. We knew without a doubt there was going to be an information lockdown, so we wanted to be prepared. If you could imagine our house that we were in the DC area, I think at one point there were 37 people there, all furiously working on laptops, all trying to make phone calls. You know, we had people calling the media. We had people putting media in touch with people on the ground. We had people writing letters to the government here, trying to get attention to be paid there. We didn't sleep. We were just like, we'd wake up, rub our eyes, and get back to turning our computers on and calling people.
Tell me about the February 17th Twitter stream in particular. This was the official day of rage.
Yeah.
What was going on that day?
Well, the feed in particular, the guy who started the Jan 25 Voices Twitter feed during the uprisings in Egypt got in contact with us and said, you know, hey, I've done this. I can help you guys do this as well. Basically, the Feb 17 Voices Twitter feed, we call contacts that we have in Libya on the ground and as much as possible get their eyewitness account of what they're seeing, what's happening. And then either record them if they feel safe enough to do that and put that up on the Twitter feed with descriptions, or just putting up what information they're giving us, because a lot of people were afraid to even be recorded.
Sarah, let's listen to what some of those calls sounded like.
The number of people who are either injured or killed is totaling 900, and the majority of them are in critical condition, because the few who are not being hit by regular bullets are hit by bullets normally used for shooting airplanes. And they are using that against the protesters. And they are still shooting right now. And I am hearing the sound of bullets used to bring down airplanes again.
That's horrifying, and I guess this man was an eyewitness to some of this, but not everything. How did you go about trying to verify these reports and make sure that your sources were reliable? How did the rules change when reporting on revolution in a Twitter world?
I think it's a judgment call, and we really are making as much concerted effort as possible to not put anything up or report anything that we haven't heard from multiple people. Even if it's an eyewitness on the phone, either we get another eyewitness on the phone, or we talk to somebody through email, or we call somebody who doesn't want to be recorded. For example, Al Jazeera Arabic was reporting over the weekend that the government was dropping bombs on Tripoli. But unless we had somebody who saw or heard a bomb, we would just never touch that, because if you are exaggerating the events, and terrible things are happening, people are being massacred by the hundreds, but if we exaggerate events, then the factual things that are happening will be ignored. So, I mean, the nature of the beast, we're limited. There's no way that we can report on Libya the same way that we reported on Egypt. There's no way. Egypt already had plenty of foreign journalists there. There wasn't as much of a media crackdown. So we're working with what we have, and that's the best that we can do.
How proactive were you in getting in touch with the mainstream press to help them in their reporting out of Libya?
We were very proactive. We would tweet at the mainstream media. You know, for example, if we saw a big mistake, one thing that, for example, was being reported incorrectly was that the initial protests that were happening in Benghazi were protests against the Libyan Prime Minister al-Baghdadi. And the source that these, I think the AP and New York Times and HuffPost LA Times were using was a supposedly independent news service in Libya called Qurayna. They didn't realize that Qurayna was partially controlled by Saif al-Gaddafi, Gaddafi's son. And we actually had to send those media outlets videos showing them the chants were directed at Gaddafi, not at the prime minister. And I think that having those videos showing protesters chanting against Gaddafi, burning Gaddafi's image, I think that really helped them to not just go by what the Libyan state line was saying, which was that it was anti-prime minister protests.
Okay, I want to end this, Sarah, with a personal question. And I want to ask you, as someone who has lived in a family of dissidents who never, over 40 years, achieved their dreams for democracy in their country, what it's like to witness and participate in what's happening now.
My father hasn't been back in Libya since, I think, 1980, for fear that if he does go back, he'll be killed. And many of my friends, my Libyan friends in this country, have similar backgrounds. At one point, one of my father's friends who happened to be in town and who himself was also part of the older generation, the dissident movement, came into where we were all working, and he was just looking around at everybody, and a lot of them children of dissidents themselves, and saying, you know, 30 years ago, we were doing what you guys are doing. You know, we were doing it in a different way. Obviously, technology has changed, but we were doing what you guys are doing. And he turned to my brother and he said, you know, your father got a phone call saying you have a son. My father wasn't there when my brother was born because he was off working with this opposition group. So, I mean, it's really, I'm getting emotional even just thinking about it now, but it's really like, it's really the continuation of something. And you know, the people that started this for us, they've gotten old and they're discouraged and they're tired. And so much of their lives were dedicated to helping the situation in their home country. And it's so disheartening that they feel that they weren't successful. We want what they did to have meaning, and we want to continue. It's the least that we can do is to help the people that are dying now and get their stories out.
Sara Abdurrahman is a producer for On the Media.
Thank you. Thanks, Bob.
Okay, thank you. Coming up, NPR's official Twitter becomes another vital source in the desperate search for information on the ground in North Africa.
Next thing I knew, I was tweeting on and off 14, 15, 16 hours a day. And it's been going on 7 days a week ever since because these revolutions keep happening.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. Learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And the Park Foundation, dedicated to heightening public awareness of critical issues at parkfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The significance of social media in the recent uprisings in the Middle East and North Africa, compared to the role of Al Jazeera, for instance, has been hotly debated. What nobody disputes is their extraordinary success in getting news on the ground to the outside world, often within seconds. Some Twitter feeds have been ongoing timelines, often with audio and video links, in popular struggles against entrenched regimes. None has been more illuminating than that of senior strategist for NPR's social media desk, Andy Carvin, who for 2 months has been tirelessly, almost obsessively, serving as a conduit in and out of Tunisia, Egypt, Bahrain, and for the past week, Libya. In so doing, he has embraced some conventions of reporting and defied others, as digital media play havoc not only with tyrannies, but with the journalistic status quo. It began with a few tweets about unrest in Tunisia.
Sometime right around the week of Christmas, I started noticing conversations on Twitter with the hashtag Sidi Bouzid, which is the name of a town in central Tunisia. Now, I've actually traveled fairly extensively in Tunisia and have a lot of contacts in the blogging community there. So I really started paying attention to what they were talking about and realized that there were protests forming in different parts of the country. As each day passed, I started seeing more people using the Sidi Bouzid tag. It grew and grew and grew, and since I knew some of these people and had met them before, I started essentially reporting on them. Ultimately, President Ben Ali left the country. And I recall that day a Tunisian blogger sent out a tweet that said, "Okay, Arab world, tag, you're it." Next thing I knew, I was tweeting on and off 14, 15, 16 hours a day. And it's been going on 7 days a week ever since because these revolutions keep happening.
More like hashtag, you're it.
Yeah, it is more like hashtag, you're it, absolutely.
While your Twitter account was significant in Tunisia and Egypt, it has become all the more so in Libya. Much of what we know is coming via tweets, many of them harvested and retweeted by you. I'm curious what your role is.
My role at NPR in general is somewhat hard to describe because the type of work I do has never existed in a newsroom's org chart before. On the one hand, I work closely with reporters to teach them how to use social media for news gathering and reporting purposes. I also occasionally report mostly online and through the All Tech Considered blog and a few other platforms. And then I also work on broader strategy of how we use online communities to strengthen the relationship we have with our public and further our journalism. So I exist somewhere between the digital business side of the company and the newsroom side. But the powers that be at NPR have always been very comfortable with me. Everyone seems fairly happy with what I've been doing.
Give me some examples of the tweets that had the biggest reaction and the biggest impact.
Around a week and a half ago, Bahrain was the country in the news. And then one evening I was at dinner in D.C. and I was literally getting up to go wait in line to get into the men's room. And I then saw my tweets suddenly get very frantic. People were saying, oh my God, they're shooting at us. Oh my God, I can't find my four-year-old. Help us. Please help us. Half a dozen people were all telling the same story, that a group of protesters were getting shot at in the middle of the night. They were tweeting as they were hiding behind bushes and behind concrete walls to stay safe. And here I am in a restaurant in D.C. trying to get into a bathroom, feeling it in real time. And it was both exhilarating and disturbing at the same time because I truly felt like I was there, and it really shook me up afterwards.
As I read your Twitter stream, it's pretty obvious that not only are you being a broker of whatever information you can get, but you're quite emotionally involved at this point.
Well, I think it's hard not to be when you're literally following so many people's lives on a minute-by-minute basis. And when they're passing along information of people they know getting killed or sharing photos and videos that are more violent and grotesque than anything I've ever seen in my entire life, it's hard not to react to that. And sometimes I just have to say on Twitter, I need to take a break for 30 minutes, or I need to go and hug my kids. I don't feel like that's taking sides. I think that's acknowledging that I'm human. I've never been a war correspondent before, and I don't necessarily claim that I am one now, but I'm certainly observing things in real time that I've never experienced before.
You mentioned that you are neither fish nor fowl in terms of NPR's traditional organizational structure, and that you're practicing a kind of journalism which not long ago didn't exist at NPR or anywhere else for that matter. That said, I can't help but notice that your Twitter stream is in more or less explicit violation of the existing NPR ethics code on grounds of, you know, advocacy and sort of a celebratory tone for the revolution. Now, that's an uncontroversial thing to be an advocate for, the end of tyranny, but nonetheless, unlike anything NPR has done before. I'm curious how management deals with you.
Management has been incredibly supportive. At first, I thought they would just look occasionally to see what I was doing and hope that I didn't do anything too embarrassing. And that's basically been the relationship I've had since the day I arrived. Regarding the ethics rules, it's complicated because, you know, I've been very careful about not saying anything myself personally about how I view the situation. But nonetheless, what I've tried to do is have the people themselves tell the story. There's no reason for me to take an opinion one way or another because there are plenty of opinions on Twitter. Bahrain is a great example because, unlike some of these other revolts that have started, you had people equally on both sides of the issue. So one group would be saying they're organizing, where others are saying, what are you doing? You're going to wreck the economy. This is crazy. We have the most liberal political reform methods in this region. Don't rock the boat. And I put both of those viewpoints out because I didn't want to make it seem like I was only showing one side when clearly there were two sides playing out on Twitter. For Egypt, though, and Tunisia and for Libya, the vast majority of people who are tweeting are supporting the overthrow of dictators, and so it's hard to try to strike an equal balance. So I'm certainly not focusing on having a view from nowhere here. I think it would be somewhat ludicrous to do that. But I also think I can do this fairly. I just want it to be an open process where everyone sees what I'm doing to gather the news.
With the disclaimer that I'm fascinated and delighted with what has come from your Twitter feed, I still have to ask how dicey it gets when you are working with members of the Libyan diaspora whose goal unequivocally is to dislodge Muammar Gaddafi. Have you had any guidance about at what point you become sort of an an agent for the revolution?
All the stuff that I've been tweeting is already out there. I mean, you hear it quoted on CNN and Al Jazeera every single day. I'm doing exactly the same. I'm just doing it nonstop. I think my role is different, but that's because everything is different now. And so the act of documenting what people are doing in a public way on Twitter and Facebook could be construed as advocacy of it, whereas I see it as simply capturing the entire narrative of it online as best I can.
Thank you. Keep up the good work.
I appreciate it, Bob. Thanks.
Keep changing the boundaries.
Yeah, that's what I'm definitely trying to do here.
Andy Carvin is the senior strategist for NPR's social media desk. Even when there are no brutal dictatorships to bring down, the digital revolution brings skirmishes every hour of every day. Some are obvious. The Mac versus the PC, Kindle versus Nook, the movie industry versus pirates, hackers versus websites, viruses versus your own hard drive. But one of the biggest battlefronts of the internet is largely out of view. It is the endless clandestine struggle for the strategic high ground on Google. So dominant is the search giant that a placement of a search result on the first page can be the difference between success or failure in retail sales and a lot more. For example, one study has shown that one-third of users click only on the top result. Another third clicks on results 2 through 5. If you're listed somewhere beyond the first page, you will be very lonely. These are differences measured in the billions of dollars. For the rest of this program, we will examine the stakes of and the ongoing guerrilla war over what Google calls PageRank, and we will examine the art and science of manipulating those rankings, a practice called SEO, search engine optimization. Our journey begins with the most valuable piece of software ever created. It's called the Google algorithm, and it's hard to define because, like the National Security Agency budget and the formula for Coke, it is top secret. We know that it ranks search results based on contextual relevance. If you type the words dog and food, you'll get a lot of results for dog food. But to choose which dog food-related website to list first, Google also counts how many other web pages have linked to it. Those links reflect what the internet at large thinks is the most relevant site, and their measurement is Google's special sauce. That and another 200 factors, which the company doesn't publicize, and which it tinkers with every single day. The goal of SEO is to exploit what is known about the Google algorithm to improve search rank. This can be as simple and benign as tagging a blog post with keywords embedded in the text, or as sinister as rigging the results, which is precisely what JCPenney did in the weeks leading up to Christmas. According to New York Times business reporter David Siegel, Penny's was landing at the top of Google results in product category after product category.
For about 3 months, they were turning up number one, sometimes number two, for dozens of very valuable search terms, things like dresses and furniture, really generic commercial terms, and sometimes more obscure things like grommet top curtains, which I wasn't aware of before. But yeah, there was this massive campaign, and it was very effective.
Organically, JCPenney would not have come up at the very top of a Google search for grommet-topped curtains and furniture. Obviously, something was afoot. What was afoot?
There are two important ways that Google ranks. There's actually several hundred factors in their algorithm, but two of the important ways. One is just the relevance of the word itself, the sort of anchor text, as they call it. And then the second very important factor are the number of links to your website. Essentially, it's like voting. So if you have a website dedicated to, say, folding paper airplanes, the more people that are fans of folding paper airplanes that link to your website, the higher your website will rank when people enter the term folding paper airplanes. What JCPenney did, or perhaps its search engine consultants did, was they set up an elaborate campaign to make it look as though JCPenney had been linked to by thousands of different websites all over the world for key search terms that they cared about. So one of those terms was dresses. And in fact, there were 2,015 websites around the world that had linked to JCPenney. You would go to these websites and you would see out of the blue the word dresses or little black dress or casual dress, and you would hit it and you'd bounce right to the JCPenney website. And these were completely irrelevant to clothing or to dresses. There was one that was on nuclearengineeringaddict.com. One was on casinofocus.com. There were websites in Russia about dentistry. But this campaign of links and having those links there really worked.
Tell me how Google reacted once your story broke.
They really took it all in stride and kind of emphasized that this is what they do, and this was sort of another day at the office. And at the same time, the punishment that they doled out to JCPenney was swift and brutal. I remember I left, I think it was a Wednesday night, to go to dinner, and at 6 o'clock I just checked for the couple dozen search terms that I'd been looking at for JCPenney, and they were all number one or number two. And when I got back at about 7:30, they had been buried. For dresses, for instance, which I'd followed pretty carefully, they were number, I think, 73. And for a bunch of other terms, they were in the 40s and the 50s. And really, when you get off that first page, you're gone. And I was feeling just the kind of awe at the power of Google. Just so much of commerce goes through this one website, and a bunch of guys in a room, led by this one guy, Matt Cutts, gets to decide who has broken the rules. And if you break the rules, you're in serious trouble.
I'm curious if the algorithm at this point is now kind of like the U.S. tax code or Windows, so layered on with various kinds of fixes and patches and add-ons that it has long since mutated far away from its original purity.
The answer to that is that nobody really knows. Google says they change their algorithm about 500 times every year. There are lots of people that are constantly testing and figuring out what those changes mean. So Google would say that they're making the product better. But the sort of sobering reality of looking at JCPenney is that there still are ways to fool this system.
David, thanks so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
David Siegel is a business reporter and increasingly the SEO cop for the New York Times. The Google engineer David Siegel referred to, Matt Cutts, is the man who stepped in to tear down what JCPenney's SEO contractors had illicitly constructed. This week he did the same for Overstock.com, which reportedly had compensated college kids to link to its pages. His interventions can be very expensive for the sites unfortunate enough to show up on his radar. And perhaps none is in more jeopardy at the moment than Demand Media, the so-called content farm that went public recently at a market capitalization of more than $1.5 billion. Typically, content farms pay freelancers piddling sums to rapidly produce online articles and videos based entirely on subjects trending high in Google searches, so that they will themselves show up on Google searches. It's a practice that nauseates journalists and very much has the attention of Matt Cutts. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, where you come in is when Google catches people trying to game the system. These people are often called black hats. Mm-hmm. Can you give me some example of black hat operations?
Black hat stuff can start from really simple, for example, white text on a white background, all the way to really complex, the sorts of things like viruses, malware. There are even people who will hack websites and then inject links that only search engines will see. People are always trying to find a way to game the system or rank higher than they deserve to rank.
There's been a lot of talk about content farms like Demand Media and Associated Content and others. And there has been a lot of speculation about what Google has done recently that would have a particular effect on content farms and make it harder for them to get their stories high up on Google PageRank.
In fact, earlier this week, we started to roll out a new change to our algorithm that tends to rank lower quality or shallow content sites lower in the search results, which ends up with higher quality sites showing up higher. We always try to have our ears open and listen to the feedback from the outside world, and that's actually something we've been working on even before people were discussing this recently.
Now, there's another issue that comes up, and that is omnipotence. You have so much market share. You are so much the only game in town at this point that you can enforce these things unilaterally without hearing or due process, putting the whole online world more or less at your mercy. Is there any process by which the people who are affected by algorithm changes and updates can make a case for themselves?
We have a webmaster forum where you can show up and ask questions, and Google employees keep an eye on that forum. And in fact, if you've been hit with a what we call a manual action, there's something called a reconsideration request, which essentially is an appeal that says, I'm sorry that I was hiding text or doing keyword stuffing, and I've corrected the problem. Could you review this? And over time, we've, I think, done more communication than any other search engine in terms of sending messages to people whose site have been hacked or who have issues, and then trying to be open so that if people want to give us feedback, we listen to that.
When you make a switch and whatever, hit send to codify it in the Google algorithm, do you and your team, you know, exchange high fives and hoot and holler because you've put another black hat out of business?
I think it's not a good idea to be completely impassioned. You don't want to act out of anger.
Yeah. Them is pretty words, Matt Cutts, and I don't disbelieve you, but there must have been at least one time when you went, take that.
Whenever you do run across someone who's especially creative and especially doing harm to users, then absolutely, it is satisfying to feel like you have made search better for everyone else. But the vast majority of the time, you really want to approach it from a centered, calm place and try to ask, what's the best thing for users? Any change will have some losses, but hopefully a lot more wins than losses.
Just doing my job, ma'am. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good talking to you.
Software engineer Matt Cutts is head of Google's web spam team. Coming up, so long, Google. Hello, Curation Nation. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Practically everyone creating content online, whether they're a content farm or the New York Times, is at least trying to monetize that content with ads. But just as JCPenney is fighting with innumerable other stores to be your first hit for dresses, the Times is fighting with millions of other sites to be your first stop for Libyan revolution. If the Times wins, it gets to sell your eyeballs to advertisers, which means that journalists are learning to write stories that will appeal to Google's bots. At its best, SEO forces media organizations to stay in touch with the zeitgeist. At its worst, it is the automation of pandering. Either way, one of the canniest practitioners is Huffington Post. HuffPo has done so well, in fact, that this month it was bought lock, stock, and Ariana for $315 million. Slate writer Farhad Manju says the new owner, AOL, was particularly impressed with the HuffPo's skills at search engine optimization.
The day of the Super Bowl, they published an article which carried the headline, "What time will the Super Bowl start?" And the only purpose of that article was to answer the question, what time the Super Bowl will start. And the lead of that article was written in such a way that it was obviously meant to perform well in search engines. The lead was something like, lots of people are asking, what time will the Super Bowl start? It's a common search query. And I'll tell you what, it did well. If you were searching for what time will the Super Bowl start on the day of the Super Bowl, you would have found that story right at the top.
If you go to the right rail of the Huffington Post, you'll see a column that says most popular. And lo and behold, there's nothing there about democracy in the Middle East. There's nothing there about the showdown in Wisconsin. There's a story about Khloe Kardashian, whichever Kardashian that might be. Ed Schultz, the talk show host, telling Rush Limbaugh, quote, wrap your fat ass in the flag. And one of the classic SEO tricks, a top 10 list, the 10 funniest presidential impressions, which I'm going to click on because I want to see them. And isn't that entirely the point?
Yeah. One of the brilliant things about what Huffington Post does is it really understands this sort of mix of tabloid news and straight news and politically sensational news better than almost any publication on the internet. And it has this mix down really well so that it publishes stories about politics, about legitimate news stories, and then it also publishes the kinds you just cited.
Content farms that create all of their content at very low cost based entirely on what is trending high in Google search and other social media mechanisms. They do crummy reporting about subjects that aren't necessarily important, just they're trending high somewhere. So what redeems HuffPo Is it that they're using the search engine optimized stories to lure you into the real journalism, or is it not redeemed at all?
They're not a content farm. I mean, what the search engines define as content farms are sites like eHow, which every time you type in a query like, how do I do X, you will see eHow rank very highly. And that kind of site exists only to capture those search results. Huffington Post is not that. Huffington Post is a news site. Google considers it a news site. It adds it into the Google News Index. But this is something that the entire web news industry does.
Slate included, I gather.
Yeah, Slate included. You know, everyone who sort of works online, we all know that there are certain tricks that you can use to get a lot of traffic. You can run lots of slideshows. You can be titillating. You can put certain keywords in headlines. I think this is a standard practice in journalism on the web. And, you know, at one point, I think it was seen as something of a dirty practice or somewhat ethically suspect, but it no longer is. I mean, I think that it's sort of seen as part of the way you write online, the way you produce journalism online. It's just part of the business.
Obviously, no news organization wants to pay no attention to the stated interests of its audience and its potential audience. On the other hand, no news organization operating properly is responding only to predetermined tastes, but is giving the audience the benefit of its own discovery, its own insight, its own judgment, you know, the sort of physician-patient relationship that has been so much a part of the American journalism model. At Slate, how much do you think about veering away from physician-patient and more towards Dr. Feelgood?
I think one of the things you learn on the web is that you have to be part of this really up-to-the-minute conversation that's going on in order to get lots of traffic, but also to be part of the discussions that are going on social networks. But it's sort of a constant battle to fight against the impulse of, you know, you can just write a news story, rewrite a blog item just in order to get your item right up at the top of a search engine, even if it might not contribute anything important. Guarding against that kind of mundane news story is part of the battle of working on the web these days.
Farhad, thanks so much.
Great, thank you.
Farhad Manju writes for Slate.com. So is this the immutable destiny for online content, the constant battle for position on Google among websites, and the constant battle with Google over how much optimization is optimum? Is there a better way to organize and choose content than eternal fealty to an algorithm? My friend Steven Rosenbaum thinks so. Steve is the author of Curation Nation, How to Win in a World Where Consumers Are Creators. And he's also CEO of video curation site Magnify.net. He says that curation, the filtering of content by devotees who earn your trust, will free us from Google hegemony. Steve, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
We've been talking about search engine optimization and building your content model around what the Google algorithm puts forward. But you say there's a second path that has to do with curation. What is curation?
Well, curation begins with this idea that Google, as remarkable as it is beginning to show kind of some wear and tear around the edges. And the reason for that is simply that there's just so much out there that their methodology, which says we can find everything with a robot, starts to kind of fall down a little bit. And what it gets replaced with, in my worldview, is this shocking idea that, in fact, the way you find things is by working with humans as opposed to robots.
Okay, working with humans, how?
So the thing about curation that makes it such a sexy idea is that it is both something we all do now and something that a new class of kind of professional curators will begin to do in the future. So, for example, if you, on your Facebook page today, recommend an article that you saw, you're already kind of curating. And some number of the people that you follow on Facebook are people who have made a decision that they want to be the leaders in their little world of Lower East Side restaurant fans or global travelers or bowlers or whatever it is that you choose to do. But the idea that this goes from being kind of a hobby to being really quite necessary in the noisy world is the thing that I find most exciting.
I get the top headlines as aggregated by Google based on what everybody else under the sun thinks is interesting. Tell me how in the Curation Nation I'm going to get my news.
So the odds are you're already beginning to kind of wander into it. I mean, if you play with, for example, on the iPad, Flipbook. Flipbook is already this device that takes kind of in a rudimentary form all of the things your friends are reading and following and lays it out in a newspaper-style layout. It's very attractive. Now, as you get more people in your community, as you follow more people and listen to more voices, that will get noisy as well. And what's exciting for me is that people get to raise their hand and say, you know what? I'm going to jump into this noise and become the clarifying voice around any particular topic that I'm passionate about.
I wonder if the world you're describing is sort of the anti-content farm.
I don't believe that the future of content is people being paid piecemeal to work as quickly as they can to rewrite pages out of Wikipedia. I'm much more a fan of Clay Shirky's worldview, which says humans like talking to one another and like making things, and we're good at it. And we don't necessarily only do it for money. The idea that content is inherently commercial and a business is a relatively new idea in modern history. And I think that what we're now seeing is people sharing with their friends and neighbors the things that they discover and that they want to share amongst themselves. It's a massive change in the way the web works. And I don't think it should come as a surprise that there's huge changes going on at Google. The CEO has been replaced and that one of the founders is back in charge, in part because Facebook caught them a little by surprise.
Well, I want to ask you about Facebook, because if the power of the algorithm is diminishing, Facebook would seem to be awfully well positioned because of its vaunted social graph. In a curation nation, does Facebook become king?
Facebook, so far, I think, has done a lot right. The thing that I would say is the most interesting and puzzling is who's going to figure out the way to say, you know what, I want to follow Bob's restaurant advice. But, you know, his advice about politics, I don't agree with him, so I'm going to tune out that part of his persona.
Now, I know as a matter of philosophy, you don't think that every trend can somehow be monetized. But if what you're saying is right, if we are headed into an online world governed by curation and not the Google algorithm, someone's going to make a lot of money. There is going to be some killer app out there. What are the killer apps?
I think the first thing is that if you think about humans as kind of the icing on the search cake, and there's going to be a human that will be the human that organizes all things barbecue sauce and a human that organizes all things bowling and all things NASCAR. And then within each of those little verticals, there'll be all the little tributary subsets. Do we mean searingly hot barbecue sauce? Do we mean Southern barbecue sauce? Do we mean New Orleans barbecue sauce? Every one of those people, by their nature, will deserve to be paid based on traffic and based on selling barbecue sauce and based on clicks on the ads on those pages. But I don't necessarily think that everyone who's on the web organizing content and making content is looking to become wealthy. I think they'd like to make a living. And the thing that I'm excited about is I think that there's lots of evidence to say that that will happen.
Steve, good luck with the book.
Thank you very much.
Steven Rosenbaum is the founder and CEO of Magnified.net and author of Curation Nation, How to Win in a World Where Consumers Are Creators. If you want a solid example of curation, you need look no farther than your online newspaper. Somewhere, probably along the right rail, is what's called the most emailed list. You read an article that you're moved to share, and you send it along to your sister or your colleague or your ex-husband, and voila, you have curated. Professors at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania have been meticulously studying what kinds of articles make the most emailed list, specifically at the New York Times. They've combed through more than 7,000 stories, using computers to check the Times homepage and most emailed list every 15 minutes for months. What they found is surprising. The list does not look like Google News. It's not heavy with Justin Bieber or top 10 Victoria's Secret models or your air conditioner is killing you. Instead, according to Professor Catherine Milkman, what gets most shared is what most inspires awe.
We had a number of research assistants read stories, and we described to them what the concept of awe is. It's something that opens the mind and is inspiring. And we made sure that they had a good understanding of this concept. We had them read some articles with us and come to a conclusion about what an awe-inspiring piece would be. And then they rated about 3,000 stories each on how much awe they inspired.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing that about the quantification of awe. Right. Can you just give me some examples of stories that were deemed by your researchers to be awe-inspiring?
One is, rare treatment is reported to cure AIDS patient. Another story was called The Promise and Power of RNA. A final example would be Found, an ancient monument to the soul, a story about the archaeological discovery of an inscription on a Turkish monument from the 8th century indicating a belief that the body and the soul were separate. What we find interesting is the connectivity issue. People tend to proselytize about awe-inspiring experiences. This is one of the main ways that religion has been thought to spread. When I have an amazing experience, I tell others about it. And so if I'm thinking about whether or not to share something awe-inspiring, part of what may motivate me is the idea that this was something we can both talk about, that will expand our minds, that will inspire us both, and perhaps bring us closer.
All right, now there is awe, as in, like, imagine the possibilities. And then there's imagine the possibilities, the anxiety-provoking story. Not as heavily emailed, but it's up there on your list.
We see that articles that are particularly anger-inducing or anxiety-inducing are more likely to make the most emailed list, while articles that are particularly sadness-inducing are less likely to make the most emailed list. For instance, here's a story that seems like perhaps it could make the most emailed list, a story called Maimed on 9/11, Trying to Be Whole Again. At some level, this was an inspiring story. It was about a survivor of the terrible attacks on 9/11, and yet it was very depressing, and it did not make the most emailed list, even though it seemed like something one might pass along. We think perhaps because it was so sad, it isn't something people wanted to be associated with.
Women authors get more emailed than males?
We indeed found that female authors are significantly more likely to be shared. That's after controlling for the topic area of the story. So whether it's an arts story versus a business story, it's not driven by women writing about a totally different type of topic. And even after controlling for things like how much awe a story induces, after we've taken all of that out of the equation, we still see that female authors are more shared.
What's your best guess as to, you know, why this is so?
I certainly don't have a single hypothesis that I think is absolutely right, but there are a number of possibilities. One is simply that women have very different writing styles than men, and that those writing styles are perhaps slightly more engaging. Another is that they do pick slightly different types of topics, even within, say, the arts section, because of their interests. And then finally, this is the most nefarious possibility, but I have to raise it. I've done some research on discrimination. There's certainly a possibility that in order to get a job at the New York Times, a woman has to be more qualified and better at what she does. And so that could also drive this effect. It could be that women are simply better at their jobs in an equivalent position, and therefore their stories are more popular.
Now, this is a wild guess, right?
I'm making a wild guess, but there's certainly evidence that we're not past the era of discrimination. So I think it's reasonable to keep that in the set of possible explanations.
I have to ask you about using the results of your scholarship, not for good, but for evil. It seems to me that to the extent that newspapers understand what gets most emailed, they're going to start kind of ginning up their story planning and the play of their stories to favor the subject matters and the authors who are more readily emailed than others. Would that be dangerous? Would that be good? What would that be?
I'm not sure it's dangerous. It certainly is dangerous if it means we stop covering news responsibly and don't cover the important topics of the day. But if a newspaper is making its articles sexier, more exciting, more awe-inducing in order to generate more readership, then I think all they're doing is something they've been doing for 100 years or longer. This is not new if they're tailoring their content in order to entice readers.
Give me your ultimate headline for the most emailable New York Times story.
Well, I'll admit this is biased by having a husband who's an astrophysicist and is searching for Earth-like planets. But I think the best headline I could imagine would be, Earth-like planet discovered harboring intelligent Buddhist life forms.
Katie, thank you so, so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Catherine Milkman is an assistant professor of operations and information management at the Wharton School. She conducted this study with her colleague, Professor Jonah Berger.
Yeah. Know what I'm saying? She is SEO rapper. Back again.
Kale.
What you thought? Let's talk about PageRank. The all-important PageRank. Know what I'm saying? took back again. So tell me what you think. New song, new dance, I call it the page run. So you wanna get the listing in the top position. If you pay attention, I can show you how to get it. Start with your content. I'd have said it before. 250 words per page, you good to go.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazneen Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sara Abdurrahman, with more help from Andrew Parsons and Carlin Gallietti, and edited this week by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keith. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director for national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Brooke will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield. I'm gonna tell you something else that works wonders. Yahoo
Directory, it costs 300. Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.